Good morning. Wow, what a lot of people. Welcome, it's good to see you all here today. And I haven't seen a group this big for a while. Yesterday we had a one-day retreat here at Sun Center, and it was a lovely day. And there's a number of you who are back. So sorry, you're going to hear the same talk again. We do repetition in Zen, so we repeat the same practice over and over again. Just coming back. So I'm going to start with this short verse poem by Thomas Merton. Listen. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? So this school of Zen is Soto School, is has a focus of silent sitting or silent illumination, and also, but within that is insight arises. We see into what's happening in our lives, in our minds, in our bodies, so both things. So this poem is about sitting down and being quiet, and also the question, you know, what is this? And who are we? What are we doing? And here's another one by Pablo Neruda called Now We'll Count to 12. And I've read this one before, you might remember it. Especially those of you who were here yesterday. Now we will count to 12. And we'll all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a while and stop waving our arms around so much. It would be an exotic moment. Without rush, without engines, we would all be together in a sudden strangeness. In a sudden strangeness. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and always threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems to be dead in the winter and later proves to be alive. So sometimes when we do a retreat and we hear all the guidelines for the retreat, you know, don't look at each other. No social contact, eye contact. Silence, don't speak, you know, just follow the schedule. When we're new to retreat, we feel a little bit strange. We feel a little bit self-conscious about that. But when we do a Rahatsu Sesshin, for instance, the one that's coming up, when we do a multiple-day sesshin or a multiple-day retreat, that kind of drops away, that sense of, you know, being self-conscious about, you know, worried about making a mistake or, oops, I looked at Ben. Uh-oh. You know, just kind of that awkward feeling drops away. And we just relax into the silence, into being together in a way where we're really quite intimate, but we're not engaging in the usual social ways. But it takes a little while. And maybe you don't sit there on your cushion and threaten yourself with death. I hope not. But as a culture, don't we do that? We do that as a culture. You know, we're gearing up for war all the time. Isn't that threatening ourselves with death? That is, you know, that's part of our human inheritance that we all take part in just by being in the human race, just by being in society. So, having had an awakening, you've all come here today to practice, as Sosan said last week, just a Buddha with a Buddha. It's a Dogen classical. Only a Buddha with a Buddha. And so we sit together, only a Buddha with a Buddha. Intimate, very intimate. Having had an awakening into the impermanent nature of our lives and into our sense of dissatisfaction of something being off, something being not quite right, we realize that we then accept what we hear, that this is caused by this craving and grasping, and by what we do with our minds, with our discursive thinking. And then we hear, oh, there's a path out of this dead end, this wandering in circles, you know, over and over existence. Ah, that path is the path of Dharma. So I don't know if that was exactly your process, but it's really exactly your process. That's how you got here, really. So I talked yesterday about how, even though at our contemporary retreats we don't have much ritual, that we're actually enacting the central ritual of Zen, which is silent sitting meditation, Zazen, or whatever it is people are doing there, just sitting, facing those walls in silence together. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the ritual of no ritual, and use some of the things that I heard at the Soto Zen conference in Oregon from the keynote speaker Paula Arai about healing ritual, and connect that to the six qualities of a spiritual life, which are actually the paramitas. But I'm calling them the six qualities of a spiritual life because paramita translates into perfection. And I'd like to stay away from that word perfection. I don't know about you, but that's one of those words that I can easily get hung up on, perfection. You know, it's like purity and perfection, you know. So one of the first of her elements of healing ritual is experiencing interrelatedness and cultivating gratitude. And so that is Dana Paramita. So in Zen, in Buddhist practice, giving is really important. Generosity is really important. I think that's why it's listed first as the first of the paramitas. And the very first thing we do is to give ourselves to ourselves in sitting practice. Just sit down. Just sit down in Settle the self on the self. Give yourself the time and the space. And give the others in, and you're giving the others in this room your presence. So you're enacting that paramita of giving. And in Zen, we focus on the non-dual. So really, the giver isn't above the receiver. And the giver, receiver, and gift is equal. It's equal. So we try to practice that. Especially when we practice together. We have the chance to simplify and see what that's like. You know, we have a problem in this culture with receiving, right? So it's a really good practice to allow oneself to be, to have no difference between yourself as receiver and the person who's giving, you know. So in other words, it's not really more blessed to give than to Not really, not in Zen. We turn that upside down. We turn a lot of things upside down in Zen. And let me read from the book where I'm going to read a little story, a brief story. They're very brief. In The Hidden Lamp, we're reading this together. Some of us in the mornings. It's the yellow one. Very simple story, contemporary. The Australian nun Chi Kwong Sanim had the opportunity to meet a 102-year-old Korean nun, Kye Jeon Sunim, who had meditated for years, many years. When Chi Kwong came into her presence, the old nun was sitting upright with a rosary of black beads and a rosary of white beads, twirling together in her left hand, silently repeating her mantra and gazing into space in front of her. The old nun grabbed Chi Kwong's hand and pulled her close. When Chi Kwong yelled in the hard of hearing nun's ear, "I'm a foreigner," the old nun held up the mingled black and white beads and said, "Let's practice together." When Chi Kwong asked the old nun about her past, she replied, "What past?" Then the old nun smiled and said, "Let's become enlightened together." Well, that's beautiful, isn't it? Let's become enlightened together. Let's not even use the word enlightened. Let's just use the word awakened. Let's awaken together. That's the only way we can do it, really. We have to make the individual effort, but we need a sangha. So let's enact the ritual of practice realization together. The reality of practice realization together. Whatever that is, we'll find out. We're on the path to finding out. It's not a dead end. It's not a dead end. So another of Paula arises. And by the way, she's coming here in March, and she is a very warm and dynamic speaker. And we have asked her to come. She is my favorite presenter at this conference. So the next quality of healing ritual is knowing and experiencing the living body and mind. And the paramita is dhyana, or meditation. So that's what we're doing here. We're knowing the living body and mind. We're enacting that knowing. We're getting to know the living body and mind. So that's very dynamic. Very dynamic. We're noticing what our minds are doing in meditation, and we're seeing it and letting it go. Seeing it and letting it go. Noticing patterns and working with them along the way. Another one, full engagement, virya, or energy, effort. And that's an effort without efforting. It's an effort that it's not too loose and not too tight, like the strings of your guitar, Ben. That works best when it's not too loose, not too tight. That's the kind of effort. That's the kind of energy. So, and the way we do that in formal Zen practice is just follow the schedule. You know, work when it's time to work. Full engagement, whatever we're doing. Whatever we're doing, whether it's creating beautiful flower arrangements or sweeping, creating order in the Zendo, or cooking. Anything that we do, full engagement, virya. And practicing the middle way doing that, of not too tight, not too loose. Another story about a famous family, the Pangs. Layman Pang and his wife and daughter, like Vimalakirti in our Buddhist tradition, were enlightened lay people. But it doesn't mean, well, I'm going to read the story. It's short. Layman Pang was sitting in his thatched cottage one day studying the sutras. Difficult, he suddenly exclaimed. It's like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seed in the top of a tree. Easy. His wife, laywoman Pang, answered, "It's like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed." Mm-hmm. "Neither difficult nor easy," said their daughter, Bling Zhao. "It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips." So, isn't it just like the children always taking? Notice the extremes their parents are going to. So Ling Zhao was, the story is that when Layman Pang became awakened, enlightened in the big way that people become enlightened in these stories, he decided that they had to get rid of all their worldly possessions. He was a wealthy man, and so he took all of their things and threw them into a lake. That's the story. So apparently wisdom takes longer to develop. Awakening is possible without necessarily wisdom being immediately present. But so they had to go to work. They became, you know, that time in China, authentic practitioners, you know, he believed you couldn't be, you know, authentic if you had all that stuff. So Ling Zhao wove baskets for them to make a living. And the thousands of grass tips, the myriad grass tips, is often used in Zen stories to speak of the myriad dharmas, all the details of our lives, all the things that go on. So I like that story. I like that family. So the next one is being with and accepting what is. What is. So you do that, you practice that in Zazen, and it really helps. It's really helped my life to do that, to sit with whatever is coming up. You know, and there's a lot of people here at Zen Center right now that are going deeper, people that are in practice period, and people that are doing Zen initiation, people that are in study groups and starting to do more retreats. And so what happens when we go deeper sometimes is that we experience that difficult Layman Pang was talking about. because we get in more, we get in touch more with what's really going on in our minds, with our conditioned reactions, responses, the ways our mind works. You know, and a couple of things that come up for people that I've heard about recently are loneliness. Loneliness is a big one. And fear. Fear of impermanence. Fear of groundlessness. What happens, you know, if I just let go? You know. Oh, I see that my old strategies aren't working anymore. Now what? You know, that can bring up a little bit of fear, a little bit of anxiety, you know. Pema Chodron, one of my favorite teachers, she speaks to that. Her books, her teachings totally speak to what happens when those things arise. And she says that loneliness, in particular, and fear are some of the more, she calls it hot feelings that they're hot in the sense that we really want to get away from them. We really want to not feel them, you know. So we try our usual strategies, use our discursive thinking to try to cope with them, and in doing that, we just become more and more entangled. We become more and more entangled because those strategies don't work, and we set up a struggle. We start to struggle instead of just relaxing with it when it comes up. Relaxing with it. So it's not easy. It's not easy. It takes courage. But courage isn't something that you arrive with when you walk in the door here. It's not something we arrive with. And courage isn't the absence of fear, right? You've heard of that. Heard that before, haven't you, from other people? It's not the absence. It's just being with it. Being with it. Sitting with it. Walking with it. Because Pema says our birthright is the middle way. Our birthright is the middle way. So that means that we become more comfortable, although comfortable isn't the word exactly, with paradox, with ambiguity, with impermanence. We can even see the beauty of impermanence. We can even see the beauty of those bare branches. Last night the sun set at the end of the retreat, and it was gorgeous. It was just the most beautiful sunset, which you could see more vividly without all the leaves on the tree. And everyone appreciated it. Everyone appreciated it. Nobody said, oh, you know, nobody moaned, pissed and moaned about, you know, the weather forecast. Everyone, you know, the fruit of our practice is sitting all day, allowed us to just appreciate that beauty without adding all kinds of stuff on top of it. Adding all kinds of stuff. So that's what we do. And the middle way is our birthright, between the extremes of, you know, grasping and struggling with things that are difficult that come up and pushing them away, you know, trying to escape them. Because being fully alive is always, it's easy and it's difficult. It's both. It's both easy and difficult, and it's not easy and not difficult. So the next one, and that I'm connecting with Kshanti, or patience, just developing the capacity to sit with whatever comes up in our life, in our practice, and to just merge with that, Having a relaxed and curious presence. Maybe being able to laugh at ourselves. Play the fool. Play the fool. It reminds me of a talk I went to at People Incorporated, Tim's workplace. He gave a talk, and there was a giant screen. It was a luncheon. There were 500 people there, a fundraising luncheon, and there was a large screen, and on the screen was a picture of the Fool card, the tarot card, the Fool. And so he talked about being a fool. He introduced people in the audience as a fool, the fool who dared to start People Incorporated, dared to do this work with mentally ill, even though things didn't look so promising at that time. And I'm going to just give a little shout out to Tim. He's retired after 18 years of service to People Incorporated. So, Tim, congratulations. Sorry, but I just really wanted to tell everyone that. being able to be a little foolish. There's a lot of fools in the Zen tradition. There's a lot of really sacred fools, ryokan and layman Peng, and they have deep wisdom, but they're not afraid to be a fool. They're not afraid to just be who they are with whatever's happening. Make mistakes, fall down, get back up again using the ground. So, and creating and appreciating beauty through sila or ethics. So choosing what's life-giving, choosing what protects life, what enhances life, that's sila, that's ethics in our Buddhist practice. Adding to what works, adding to the beauty, contributing, appreciating beauty. And that's an important element to ritual, too. We need that. We need beauty. Let's add to the beauty. So, it's also renunciation. You know, we renounce overtly harmful actions. But I like the idea of protecting life. And I like that idea. Choosing what's life-giving. We can do that every day. And the last one is expanding perspective and embodying compassion, or prajna, wisdom. So, that's about going beyond our ideas. Going beyond our ideas, good and bad, right and wrong, whatever, all of our preconceived notions. Seeing those, going beyond prajna. It's about non-seeing our interconnectedness. It's about seeing non-separation in relationships. It's about listening and speaking from the heart. That's the practice with people, with relationships. It's practicing non-separation. It's understanding that we all want the same thing as human beings. We want to be happy. We want to be happy. Our ideas of what happy is change when we practice the middle way. But basically, we understand that everyone, everywhere, just wants that, what we want. That's practicing and enacting prajna. First, we see that our self is empty. We're not our ideas. We're not our concepts. That's not us. There may be a feeling of groundlessness there when we see that deeply, when we practice deeply and we see that. But then the way to work with the groundlessness is to, as Pema says, is to just be with it. Connect to the soft spot, the vulnerable place in us. And then it's so much easier to relate to other people from a place of non-separation. Just to you become more kind. So that's how compassion and wisdom work together, prajna. You know, there's the sword of Manjushri. There's a cutting through of delusion, self-delusion, you know, seeing all the stuff that's not true self. And when that happens, we do that again and again. Then we do connect with our human vulnerability, and compassion emerges from that. So, that's really my whole talk for today. A half an hour to... Ted told me I should only speak for a half an hour today. Or that would be a good idea. Oh, well, we could have a couple questions, I think. I think there's time for that. I believe that's within the realm of possibility. Or comments or additions. Anything you want to add?
I just want to say that paramita, you know, the word perfection is kind of an old translation and it's sort of habitual, but it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, most of these words that come from other cultures and other times don't have direct translation. So therefore, there are lots of other ones to choose from. Mm-hmm. Perfection and love. Mm-hmm. People are choosing other words besides perfection. That those is kind of kind of become sort of antiquated.
That translation. Yeah. Do you have one that you like?
I know ideal is one that sometimes is used, or I can't think of. I mean, every time I struggle with it, I go and I look it up actually on the internet. I sort of different ones sort of appeal to me at different times, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of different ones out there. So their choices, you know, kind of reject the word out of him because these words are so enculturated mm-hmm. that when you take them out of the culture, then you have to sort of finagle them to fit the structure.
Qualities of spiritual life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Arai. Arai. Yes, you could Google her.
Yeah. And she's from Asia.
Oh well, she used to. That's where she teaches.
She's in Baton Rouge now.
Mm-hmm. She used to be Ted's neighbor in Northfield, actually. She taught at Carleton, did she? Mm-hmm. Yeah, previously.
You talked a bit about our true self, which we practice sitting or resting in, or what does Mahayana Buddhism say about? I mean, we kind of have our individual personal self as well, and a relative self. Some meditation centers kind of just seems like people are really in this complete side, not particularly this one, but there are certain traditions in Buddhism that just kind of people kind of push the relative self, personal self out the door and kind of stay in
that level of I think that those words relative and absolute, we don't tend to use them a lot in Zen, but what we try to do is teach the integration of the ultimate awakened awakened self, Buddha, only a Buddha with a Buddha, without rejecting the self of the personal history and personality and conditioning of the individual. Yeah, that's all part of who we are. And those are Dharma gates. All of our hindrances, you know, our conditioning are actually seen as Dharma gates, as the entrance into reality as it is. So instead of, you know, struggling with it or tossing it out, we just go into it, but without a lot of conceptualization. Just sitting with it.
So in some sense, is it, well, if I just think that a lot of times certain aspects of ourself can pull us out of the present moment. Maybe some of those aspects of ourself need to be nurtured or developed or owned.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. None of that is left out. None of it's left out. I agree. We need to take responsibility, be with it, care for it, you know. Hold it gently. Works better than trying to destroy it or fix it. That part. Okay, is that it? Oh, sure.
How do you think is a good way to think about a sense of progress in meditation? Because it seems like almost thinking about progress is counterintuitive. If you're thinking, well, I want to get somewhere,
then
that's probably
true. We have to hold both. We have to hold that paradox of, you know, like I said, we don't want to pursue dead ends, you know, but the Eightfold Path, Buddha's way, it is actually a proven way, you know, to awakening. So, but you know, we try, and so does, and especially to stress not striving, not having goals. You know, we just learn these things, then we let go of them. We learn them, we contemplate them, and we let go of them. You know, we don't harden them. We don't use them to reinforce a sense of self. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So what's the paradox, you know? Both and. Anything else? I think that we are probably done with discussion then. Okay, thank you for listening. Thanks for being here today.